Welcome to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 36 for the week of July 29th, 2009. Welcome
back to the Experience Points Podcast. I'm George Albor.
I'm Scott Chester.
And we are the co-creators of experiencepoints.blogspot.com, a site dedicated to serious but humorless analysis of video games and culture. And if you're a first-time listener, what we do each week is we grab a story that's on the web and bring it to you fresh scoops.
Fresh from the internet's bakery.
Yes. What are we talking about today, Scott?
Today we have an article that we got from Gamasutra, and it's written by Stephen Conway. The title of the article is called A Circular Wall, Reformulating the Fourth Wall for Video Games. And in it, he talks about breaking the fourth wall in the in context of video games.
Yeah, and it's a pretty in-depth article, and I do recommend that anyone who's listening should go ahead and read it first. He's really comprehensive. He brings a lot of good examples. For people who might not know, the fourth wall, I think, is originally a theatrical term.
Mm-hmm.
And it referred to, of course, the three walls that are on the stage, the left, right, and the back wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that fourth wall is the one between the audience and the players.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that the players oftentimes directly talk to or engage with the audience in a way that essentially kind of stops it from being a play.
Mm-hmm.
And so he applies this to video games in a pretty interesting way and covers some cool examples.
And throughout history, the fourth wall has changed a little bit too, because, I mean, what is breaking the fourth wall for a movie or TV where there's like, you know, it's not situated like a stage.
Right.
But what it is, it's a self-awareness that it is a piece of entertainment, or it's directly talking to the audience when in the fiction of the production the audience doesn't exist. So I mean, it's basically a self-awareness type thing, or talking directly to the people that are consuming the
right.
material.
Scrubs does it a lot.
That is a great example, like Scrubs or Malcolm in the Middle. I remember that was one of my favorite shows that did it. But anyway, so he talks about it in terms of how video games handle this, and a couple of the ways he identifies three major ways that video games tend to break the fourth wall, or what he would argue is just reposition this wall, but we'll get to that later. So a character can directly address the player. He brings up the good example of Sonic tapping his foot when you don't play for a while. Like, if you put down the controller, he'll start looking at you.
He's a very impatient hedgehog.
He has attitude and batitude. It was the 1990s.
Yeah.
Another way is a game that directly acknowledges itself as a game.
Matt Hazard is a good example of that.
Yeah.
Where he's completely aware that he's a video game character.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, whether or not that breaks the fourth wall is kind of questionable.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, every once in a while a game will make reference to, oh, press the reset button or something like that. And, you know, the reset button tends not to exist in game fiction. So, I mean, it's a way of acknowledging the fact that it knows what it is.
Right.
And then a third way is referencing something in the game that exists outside of the game fiction. Like, he brings up the example of in God of War, Kratos at one point attacks David Jaffe, the creative director. and so that's kind of a, you know, they're both real things. Kratos is real in the fiction of his universe. David Jaffe is real in our universe, and bringing them together is kind of a break of the fourth wall.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Another example that is interesting is the Psycho Mantis changing the controllers, or making the controller vibrate in the Metal Gear Solid game, especially because that just brings attention to the hardware.
Yeah.
So
that's, we'll see that, and that's a good lead into one of the most interesting things that Stephen Conway talks about, because he makes this argument that, let's take the Psycho Mantis thing for an example, or he also does the he also uses Naomi as an example. In Metal Gear Solid, there's, especially in the PS1 Metal Gear Solid, the original one, they used the DualShock as something that expanded the game universe. They weren't breaking he argues that they weren't breaking the fourth wall with it, because it was still within the confines of the game.
Right.
So Psycho Mantis is telling Snake, I can move things with my mind, and then moves the controller. And so what happens is the fourth wall is actually extended behind the player. You become part of the game because the game is controlling parts of the real world, which is kind of a mind warping thing.
It was when I played that. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, it's interesting because they're just essentially using the hardware as another extension of the story.
Yeah.
Which is fun. It's unique. I mean, at some point it's novelty, right? Mm-hmm. At some point you say Psycho Mantis is really interesting when he messes with my memory card or something, specifically because he's messing with my memory card and no one else has ever done that in a video game.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think it is breaking. Oh, so for example, to go back to the Naomi example.
Yeah.
What she does in Metal Gear Solid is at one point suggests that you need a break. You need to relax. And she suggests that Snake put the controller on his neck, and then the controller vibrates on your neck, giving you a kind of like pseudo massage.
Yeah.
It's strange because Snake doesn't have a controller. So what she says is meaningless to the real Snake in the game.
But you know, I think I have to interject here because if I remember this correctly, and you know, we're doing this on the fly here. I'm not on the Metal Gear Wiki or something like that. Right. But what I think she says is, I'm going to stimulate the nanomachines in, like, your arm or something like that to relax the muscles. And so...
And then the game tells you to put the controller on your neck?
Yeah, or your arm. Like, because I think this happens after you're pressing the circle button really fast not to be tortured to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so she comes in on the radio and says, I'm going to stimulate your muscles using our remote-controlled nanomachines that we've injected in your body. And so then... That would be happening to Snake as well. He'd be feeling a vibration because his muscles would be spasming. And so it's trying to simulate what is happening.
I understand that. Yeah. But does she use the word control?
I don't know if she does.
Or does the interface thing pop up and say, hey, Scott, put this controller on your arm.
We'll have to... That's my store and I'm sticking to it. Okay. No. We're going to... I told you, that's where they told me to put the controller. I think we're going to have to put this in the show notes, but... There is some effort to keep it within the fiction of the game at some points. But the Psycho Mantis example, when he examines, he's like, now I'm going to read your memory card. Oh, you like playing Castlevania.
I'm going to bring this up again, like you did. I actually think he says, I'm going to read your mind. And then he mentions things off of your memory card. Of like, oh, you've been playing such and such lately.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
It's a shame that I don't know off the top of my head, but I also think that he says, I don't know if he mentions the word save, but he'll say, oh, you're brave. You haven't saved very often.
No, he said, you have not saved often.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a more traditional breakage self-awareness. Of the wall. Yeah, because it's not extending the fourth wall behind the player. It's calling the player's attention to the fact that they're playing a video game.
Right. But it's weird, too, though, because Snake... doesn't respond and go, what? Why? What are you talking about, Psycho Mantis? It's just like, I don't know what you mean by save.
Yeah.
So
this is very much like Kojima's thing. I mean, like Kojima does, at the same time, like if we're going to use Conway's method of looking at the fourth wall as a sphere that sometimes exists behind the player so that the player is actually part of the game and not watching the game, Kojima practices the fourth wall in both respects. Sometimes he brings it out past the player and makes the player a part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he brings the player's attention to the fact that they're playing a game by like causing a malfunction of the TV and it shows the video thing, but it actually says his name.
Right.
You know, it says Hideo instead of video. I mean, that's something that snaps you back to reality and makes you realize, oh, I'm playing a game. When Psycho Mantis is vibrating things and calling it mind control, and that's starting to, or here's a good example from Metal Gear as well. When you first contact Meryl on your codec, she tells you, oh, okay, the codec code is on the back of the box.
Right, and you have to go get the box.
You have to go to the box and look at the preview picture on the back of the box to look to get her codec. And so simultaneously, they're bringing the fourth wall out behind you by making the part of the world the game world, and at the same time, drawing your attention to the fact that you are playing a video game by her calling it a box.
Right, and this is kind of...
It's happening at the same time.
And this is kind of Conway's point, right? Like, this term, fourth wall, and all of these terms that we use to understand... how characters will interact with the audience in non-traditional ways mm-hmm. is really cumbersome with video games.
Yeah.
Because I would say that Naomi interacting with you with a massage mm-hmm. thing is still breaking the fourth wall, but it somewhat depends on how much you are willing to consider yourself as Snake,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I mean, even with looking on the back of the box, mm-hmm. not only is it pointing to the fact that, well, what box are you talking about? Why do you have this box?
Snake knows all about boxes, only the cardboard variety.
Right, that's exactly true. But it's also referring to you as the agent, the actual agent.
Yeah.
Snake doesn't really have the agency. It's you, the mm-hmm. person with the box.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I don't know how comfortable I am mm-hmm. imposing myself upon the protagonist.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I understand some of the other things Kojima has done, mm-hmm. especially with messing with the screen, you mm-hmm. know, mailed fission or whatever,
yeah,
fission
yeah.
mailed instead of mission failed,
mm-hmm.
is kind of like a stylistic choice, mm-hmm. kind of what you see in cinema when people have lens flares, Conway mentions,
mm-hmm.
and some other, you know, dirt on the camera, that kind of thing he mentions as well.
Yeah.
That's just a stylistic choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
That can add to a scene or take away from a scene depending on the feel you want to make, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of sci-fi shows have lens flares because we've just associated sci-fi with lens flares.
Yeah, yeah. When Serenity flies into the distance, you see some flare from it.
Exactly.
But I mean, and Conway brings up that that's actually a subtle breakage of the fourth wall because it's bringing attention to the fact that you're watching something.
Right, but at some point, haven't we internalized that behavior? Like, there's so much about video games that is unrealistic, even the games that are very narrative-driven, that break away from the story in a way that something like maybe a movie doesn't or a play doesn't as much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the interface, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There's no interface for a film. There's no interface for a play. You just sit there and watch.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I have to worry about saves, the fact that I can pause and go to the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
all of these things are in some way, shape, or form, reminding you while you're going through the experience that this is, in fact, a doctored experience. This
mm-hmm.
is fake,
mm-hmm.
right? There's so many of them in games that at what point do we just say, okay, well, we've internalized that. That's a part of games, period.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to know, and I think the strength of this article is saying that using the fourth wall, like the whole discourse around the fourth wall starts falling apart when you talk about it in terms of games, because you do interact with it so much more. Like, a game wouldn't function if you don't interact with it. His example about Sonic is pointing out that who's playing who here? Sonic is tapping his foot, compelling you to play the game. Like, he's the one in control. He's making you want to play the game. You're not making him want to play his game. He's making you want to play the game.
That's
you
a good
know?
Point.
So, I mean, like, when we start talking about TV or theater and film, it's a whole nother set of things. I mean, when you're in the theater or when you're in a movie, you're not worried about your inaction damaging the experience. But with a video game, you have to worry about how your interaction is going to affect the experience.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if now that we're getting into this new era of motion sensor, and like I'm looking at Project Natal, and I'm wondering, like, is this just the extension of the magical sphere, like the fourth wall? Are we trying to push it back in terms of control now? Because if you want to make my whole living room part of the game with Project Natal, I guess you could.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like, you could say, oh, I see you have a huge bookcase in your living room. You know, I mean, something that wouldn't necessarily be possible with
creepy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in that sense, the wall disappears. You just become part of the game.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right, yeah. as I see it.
I don't know, going at it in a different direction. Were there times where you thought either breaking the fourth wall or expanding the fourth wall behind you so that you're part of the game? Are there specific games that you felt that worked really well in? Like certain experiences that you had that were really improved by feeling like you just weren't watching a game or you just weren't playing a game. You were actually kind of interacting with it.
Uh-huh. I think Metal Gear Solid is the only example that comes to mind.
Your Star Tropics example?
That's true. Well, yeah. But see, that didn't work well for me.
Yeah, that's true.
Conway mentioned Star Tropic as well, and I've mentioned it once before in the podcast, but it was a game that I purchased used as a child
mm-hmm.
and was stuck and spent hours upon hours trying to
yeah.
get past a certain point that, in fact, I could not have gotten past without the the map that came with the game, mm-hmm. right? Which is extending that wall, much to my frustration as a child, because I didn't know that there was a wall to extend, right? I thought it was just a normal game. That didn't work out too well. But it's strange, too, because at the same time, I have a very large fascination with alternative reality games, mm-hmm. and I would love to play a really compelling ARG that maybe sends me emails and starts breaking down those walls, and it almost encourages me to feel so immersed that it's up to me to remind myself that I'm playing a game, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that the Wii actually does provide some of those experiences. Wii Sports, some of the games on the Wii Balance Board, you get so into the movement, that body movement of it, that you do kind of have to remind yourself, like, okay, like, this is just, don't flail your limbs. You're looking really stupid right now.
But sometimes flailing your limbs actually helps you get into that experience. Right. Not only in a physical sense, because you don't realize actually how much it shifts your weight when you also shift your arms, because it does make a difference. But you're also thinking about how much you are imbuing the game with fun rather than what the game is providing you as fun.
Right.
You know, and that's pushing the wall behind you, because then there's an interplay going back and forth. You're not just receiving what the game has to give. It's a two-way channel.
And that's why I think that it's actually a really delicate situation, because I don't think one or the other gives you more agency. Uh-huh. It just gives you a different feeling, right? Uh-huh. It just evokes a different sensation. I mean, to bring it to some of the things that we've talked about the past couple weeks, I don't think that one way or the other is more authoritative from the perspective of the developer. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it largely depends on how you want to approach the character you're playing as, right? It works for the Wii games because I'm fine being the one who's imbuing meaning into the game. Mm-hmm. But if it were something like in Fallout 3, right, where I'm trying to roleplay as a character, I don't want to be reminded. I don't want the wall extended to me, because the best thing I can do right now is to look at the character and see what the character is doing. Mm-hmm.
You want to look at it as a performance, like the character on screen is performing.
Well, no, see, it's hard though, because it's almost like I feel sometimes that I can roleplay better if I'm not involved in that character's performance. Mm-hmm. But roleplaying does in some way, shape, and form imply that I'm that character.
Yeah.
For example, just to get into the nitty-gritty of it, right? We have a Fallout 3 character. Mm-hmm. However, it's up to me to decide where they're going to be leveling up their skills.
Yeah.
That's something that they didn't need to put into Fallout 3. There's a few other games that will level up your skills based upon how often you use them.
Uh-huh. Or just automatically. Like a lot of JRPGs, you just get random amounts of experience.
Just automatically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, to a certain extent, is more realistic. Mm-hmm. However, in Fallout 3, I want to roleplay, so I like being able to choose where they go, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, imagine a Fallout 3 game where they extended that fourth wall and started telling you strange things. Like, what if they took your location based upon where your Xbox 360 was located
and
been like, oh man, the weather in California is great, I hear on the radio, or just other sorts of weird things to include you. Mm-hmm. I think that might make me uncomfortable.
It also might disengage you from the fiction, because you would realize in the back of your head that someone playing in Kansas would be having a different type of experience, not because of their own personal choices in the game, but because of a technical aspect. Because they have a different IP address than you, they'll have a different experience. And so there's an amount of arbitrary decision making there that might remind you of the limits of technology and the limits of the game.
Well, okay, think of a game then that you're playing. Maybe even one of the games that we're playing right now.
Yeah.
Can you think of a way that they could extend the wall or even break the wall in a way that will improve it or hurt it in any significant way?
I mean, I think a lot of games, a lot of really good games, and I think this also comes with age as a series ages, start winking at the camera a little bit more. They might not explicitly reference something from outside the game fiction, but they might start giving slight nods to the fact that their audience knows what's going on. So, like, we're playing Majora's Mask right now.
That's a good example.
And the character of Tingle is a wink at what people know from the outside world. Tingle is a 35-year-old guy who thinks a fairy is going to come and he's going to go on a great adventure. He dresses in green and his dad tells him to get a job, but he doesn't want to because he loves exploring the world and drawing maps.
Right.
That is an explicit wink to the stereotype of a gamer.
Yeah. Like, or insult, yeah.
Yeah, or insult. But like, we know what Nintendo is doing by creating that character,
mm-hmm.
even though it's justified in the game world. And so it's not quite expanding the wall behind us. We're not in the sphere, really, because he's not really referencing anything that's outside of the universe of Hyrule or Termina in Majora's Mask. Nintendo is looking at their audience and acknowledging that they know what's going on.
Right.
And I think a lot of games do that, and I think I enjoy that because it shows that sometimes they don't take it too seriously. Even in a very serious game, you can still have moments of levity and realize that this game fits in as a cultural artifact in a wider wider medium and a wider context. Like, not only just its medium, but also what other films, books, people's lives. Like, you know, some people may feel like Tingle every once in a while. Like, they're kind of too old to be believing in magic, but they still want to anyway.
Yeah.
And so that's why they play Zelda. And this character is kind of a wink at what happens to some of those folks, like how they feel. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. I feel that's a pretty good use of it.
It's interesting because I think in Majora's Mask, that breakage it works really well, partly because it's a change in pace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's only so much of complete immersion that you can handle, you know, like something like Far Cry 2, for example. A lot of points in that game are walking through a wasteland. If your car is destroyed and you're just walking from point A to point B, it could take you quite a long time.
Yeah.
If there were a little inside joke, if there was a little, you know, for example, the diamond cases. Why are there so many diamond cases? Just no one's looking? What the hell? And my GPS can somehow track them?
Mm.
I mean, of course there are things that all games do that point out the fact that they are games.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is we're trained to internalize them and see them not as jarring, but as pace-changing design choices.
Yeah, no, yeah, we're trained to accept them and their contrast or their juxtaposition or anything else that might break the fiction of the game world. We're trained to look at them as positives in a way, because it's not supposed to be real life.
Right. And I think the Link example is interesting because it's somewhat of a narrative thing that we're not really trained to expect characters to be making fun of actual cultural things.
Yeah.
But when we see it, we remember, go, oh yeah, that's funny. I like that.
Yeah. One of the games that I always come back to that does a lot of traditional self-awareness as far as video games go is Eternal Darkness. It was a cult hit on the GameCube, and Conway mentions it in his article as well, but I just think it was a really clever way of both drawing attention, like using video games, the strengths and weaknesses of the medium itself, to make the player feel what the character must be feeling. So there's a sanity meter in Eternal Darkness, and when you see crazy stuff like zombies coming out of the floor and stuff, you lose some of your sanity. And if your sanity drops too low, weird shit starts happening. So, I mean, you could walk into a room and your character can be huge, like Alice in Wonderland huge, and then you'll blink and the screen will flash and you'll become normal again.
Right.
Or it can be something like you'll walk into a room and all of a sudden it'll look like the game reset or something. And you don't know what's going on. I even stood up at one point to like see if my thing had become unplugged, and then it flashed back. And I was like, "Oh, okay, no, that's okay. Maybe my GameCube's on the fritz or something." And then I took a look at the sanity meter and realized that it was so low, and that was a sanity effect.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, sure, that is kind of becoming self-aware, but it's also meant to make the player feel. I think it's a role-playing mechanism, really, because it's meant to make you empathize with what the player must be going through. They're seeing these crazy things, inexplicable anomalies, ghosts, strange visions, and you can't really you can imagine how you'd feel if weird stuff was happening. But when weird stuff actually does start happening to your game, then you can kind of get a sense of what that must be like for that player.
Right.
Yeah.
So how far are you willing to go? I mean, how much is too much for you? Like, would you get into an ARG? If someone was like, blue pill or red pill, Scott? Right?
I don't know. I've never really participated in an ARG or even like role playing to that much. I mean, I enjoy sarcastic humor a lot, and I enjoy self-aware storylines, mm-hmm. especially when they're playing with long-standing tropes of video games. But I don't know. I mean, I guess it really just depends on what it's going for. I mean, Metal Gear, I'm always really conflicted when it comes to Metal Gear, to like reference this game again. I mean, it seems like in one breath, Kojima is trying to make this game be a completely serious meditation on modern life. And then in the next breath, there's like a poop joke and a joke about the reset button and like Otacon references a video game or something. And so it leaves me feeling really conflicted about whether this is actually a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, do you think games need to make a choice? Go for one, like either envelop the player in the fiction or really respect the fourth wall? Should it be one or the other?
I think that, I mean, again, like a lot of times, I mean, it's always the laziest and probably the best answer, but it kind of depends. Right? I mean, at some point, like I was saying, it has to do with pacing. It has to do with how you choose to immerse someone. And bad references are going to happen, right? People are going to make poor decisions, and it's just going to come off as tacky or inappropriate at times. If you're in a very serious situation and then someone mentions like, oh, good golly, I'm sure glad I don't, you know, I hope, I'm sure glad this isn't a video game, it can come off wrong, you know?
So maybe what I think is that I think that people enjoy a unified experience, like as far as if the game's going to be self-aware and either reference things that don't exist in the game world or expand the wall behind you to make it a sphere, to make your outside world a part of the game as well. As long as it's consistent, it'll be okay. But it's weird when things are sometimes very serious and sometimes very traditional, and then all of a sudden it breaks down.
Yeah, but I do think that you can have jarring situations. I mean, even that could be done to good effect, right? For example, in literature, I'm a huge fan of novels that you can't really trust the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Something like House of Leaves, where there's layers of people telling you the story, and they are saying that it's real even though it's not, and Nabokov does it a lot as well. In video games, you can, in general, trust the narrator. You can trust what you see on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Eternal Darkness, fantastic example of you cannot necessarily trust what you see.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's a little upsetting that they even had an insanity meter to warn you that what you're seeing might not be real.
Yeah.
I want to be lied to more often. Like, what if your controllers were mapped one way and then they started changing as the game progressed?
They did that. Insanity meter. Like,
brilliant. It's a shame I actually haven't played Eternal Darkness.
I got it. You're going to play it.
I think we're too comfortable behind our wall, and I don't think that we break it as often as we seem, because essentially there's so many things that remind us that it's a game, that we've become used to it, and it's not affecting anymore. In the way that a wink at the camera in Scrubs can be hilarious, I don't think it can be in video games. I mean, it can when you're referring to maybe a specific game and poking fun like Tingle, but you know, save points, we're used to them. Jumping around a lot when it's unnecessary, we're used to it. The fact that Link can't jump, we're used to it, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that if we want to make break the fourth wall in clever and cool ways, people need to think of clever and cool ways to do it.
I know we got to wrap up pretty soon, but this comes back to one of the things that I feel like is fundamentally misunderstood about BioShock. BioShock gets a lot of flack for supposedly creating a false set of choices for you to make. I think the way I view BioShock is on a much more meta level. Like, I thought BioShock was a huge wink at the camera as far as what video games are, because we are trained in video games to just do whatever we're told. A narrator tells us to go do a mission, okay, we go do it, and things always tend to work out somehow. But in BioShock, when you're betrayed by someone that you never had the choice to disobey, it brings into contrast the way that we play all games.
Right.
It's a lesson. BioShock is more of a fable than it is anything else. You know, it's a statement about what video games are. I don't think it was even really meant to be a choice. It was meant to be Levine's way of saying, that objectivism is not ultimately in anyone's self-interest. On top of that, why do we never question what narrators tell us to do in games? And it wasn't meant to solve that problem by showing a game that successfully subverts the narrator, that allows the gamer to subvert the narrator. It just shows us the problem. And I think that's what makes people frustrated about it.
Yeah, because it's something that you see as inevitable, right? Like, how do you change it? Of course you're not going to have any say over what is going on.
But you never think about that exactly. In any game.
And that's why people like Clint Hawking are vocal about saying, no, we actually can change how stories are told, and we can break the fourth wall, and we cannot break the fourth wall.
Yeah.
I mean, even something like Portal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the GLaDOS is telling mm-hmm. you at one point, well, it's time to die, you've played the game, but mm-hmm. you break her narrative control. Mm-hmm. You're still being funneled, but at some point that's effective because you are not doing what you as the player have become used to doing in mm-hmm. video games.
I don't agree with that because mm-hmm. Portal has a point A and a point B. Like, there is a point. Like, Portal is a set of challenges.
Right, but this is where it gets really
hard. It's not a statement. Like, GLaDOS is telling you to do these rooms, and she continues to tell you to do these rooms until you become trained to just see a room and do it.
And this is where it gets hard, and this is why people are frustrated, I think. And, I mean, I know we're going on, but at some point, the only other option to ever really do anything is mm-hmm. to just turn off your console, right?
You're going back to the whole last winter's Prince of Persia discussion.
I'm just saying it's really difficult to say that the best way to break the fourth wall and give agency to a player at the same time is to remind them that it's just a game and therefore give them the power to stop playing it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, I mean, that's the holy grail, is to have them realize the way that they're playing and then have the option within the game rules to play it differently.
Yeah.
And that's something that's really hard to do. My whole point about bringing up the whole, like, Bioshock quagmire is that I don't think people realize how effective Bioshock was to even get us thinking about these problems. Like, I think Bioshock's success lies in the fact that we're having these discussions. I don't think Bioshock was out there to make the definitive way to show choices in games. I think Bioshock's purpose was to demonstrate to us how meaningless choices are in games.
Right, but then this is where the clash comes.
I think Bioshock is self-aware, what I think.
Right, yeah. But this is where the clash comes in terms of breaking the fourth wall, right? Yeah. Is because there's so many other elements of Bioshock that bring you into that fictional world.
Yeah.
That to then say what you've been experiencing is meaningless, mm-hmm. it's jarring, right?
Yeah.
When you say, God, look at those visuals, you feel like Rapture is such a real place, and the Little Sisters are real characters, and, you know, Fontaine are all mm-hmm. real characters, that to then say, but that's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really care if you're into it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
they
succeeded too well at some point,
according to you. No, that's true. I think when you start believing the characters too much, that's when people do feel betrayed. But I don't think it was meant to. I don't think it was meant in a punitive sense. I mean, you can still
they weren't rubbing your face in it.
Exactly, and some people did feel like they were, like Clint Hawking specifically feels like they were rubbing your face in it. But I think it misses the point by even showing that it demonstrates why are people hurt when they finish Bioshock, when they realize that their choices meant nothing and they were betrayed? They're hurt because they're embarrassed. Right? Like, they thought that they had a choice, and they believed it. They believed in the game. Why are we believing in this game? We might as well be believing GLaDOS when we're playing.
Yeah.
And that, for me, that's the point of Bioshock, because it's meant to point out how silly we are for just obeying these things all the time. And now that we know that, we can start constructing games that give us the options to subvert it.
By saying, look, we've already broken the wall, you're playing a video game, now what do we do with it?
Yeah, what should we do from here on out? I don't know. Like, it's one interpretation of it. I think Bioshock will continue to be interesting in this respect because it's just really fruitful for everyone that continues to go back and mine it. And it also helps to give it some rest. Like, I think we're just on the point where in a couple years we can re-examine Bioshock in the wake of games like Far Cry 2 that seem to be very much a response to what Bioshock is, and a response to, instead of breaking the fourth wall, incorporating the player into the game world. Like, just there's no fourth wall anymore. The fourth wall is behind the player somewhere. We can't even see it, right. Just like Conway was talking about.
You mean when we participate in the ultimate game?
Hunting someone. That's Project Natal. So a lot of things. We touched on a whole bunch of material. So if there's any of it that you want to comment on, take issue with, send us an email at experiencepoints@gmail.com.
Also, feel free to comment in the comment section on our blog. We update Monday, Wednesday, and Friday evenings with our own postings, and we always appreciate that. So, also, we haven't mentioned this before, but if you ever encounter a story that you see online that you want us to talk about, or if you find a subject really interesting and you want us to talk about it, send us an email. We'll see how it works.
Yeah, if you want us to drone on about random topics on the internet, you should send them our way. We are more than happy.
Picks?
We will extend that fourth wall all over everyone. Way. We're all just in the same room right now. So until next time, have fun.
Every time we